Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On a Friday, in no particular order, the Hamiltonian roots of American trade policy, identity theft, the crime that keeps on taking, and what happened in this economy while you were distracted by, you know, that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, Friday the 11th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will, in the next 5 minutes, parse the economic from the political of the 5 days gone by, the tangible from the existential, if you can even believe I am saying that. Neela Richardson's at Redfin. Sheila Kolhatkar is with The New Yorker magazine. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
Neela, can we start with you and actual economic statistical news that came out today? The consumer price index, inflation at the consumer level, up 1.7. It's running at an annual rate of 1.7%, which is basically bupkis and below where the Fed wants it. What's going on?
You know, it's a tale of two things, right? We haven't seen the wage increases that we've wanted to see. And so there's no pricing pressure in the economy right now. And that's perplexing the Fed. They don't know why. We are below full unemployment rate. And so there should be some wage pressure. But it's interesting. That statistic is more important for what it hides than what it reveals, because the shelter is growing at three times the rate of consumers, other consumer prices.
Shelter, so you mean rent and mortgages?
Like your rent,
yeah.
Our rent, our house prices. So the rent is still too high and wages are still too low. So consumers are feeling inflation, even if the Fed isn't.
Sheila, let me move away from the actual and get into the as I said, the existential a little bit. And I want to talk about the markets, not for the market's sake, but for the uncertainty's sake. I don't know that there's anything more uncertain than the prospect of the president of the United States talking about thermonuclear war. And yet Wall Street, except yesterday when there was a little blip, Wall Street's going along saying la, 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 la with its fingers in its ears. Can corporate profits be that powerful?
I think the market has demonstrated a remarkable amount of resiliency in the face of just real sort of chaos in Washington, real unpredictability coming out of the president, this sense that at any moment he could tweet something and spark a trade war, a nuclear war, you know, alter the priorities in Congress. And also the fact that the members of Congress have been unable to pass any of the major legislation that was promised that businesses were very excited about. So it's a little baffling. My sense is that those on Wall Street who have a lot of influence over the market indices have learned to shrug off a lot of what Trump does. And I think that might be another example right here. There is also some research just about how markets respond to different war threats. And apparently, grumbling about North Korea is often something that is not taken seriously. So that may continue until it needs to be taken seriously.
Wow. Neela, to the thing that Sheila said about the president and his agenda and this war of words he seems to be having with the majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, the man who, in theory, holds his legislative agenda in his hands. What happens now with taxes and infrastructure and all the rest of the stuff that the president wants to get done? Still, health care is supposed to be coming back to the table. What happens? I mean, it's not like they made great progress so far.
You know, Kai, Shakespeare has come back to Washington in terms of this president. It's full of sound and fury.
Oh,
the world
is
a stage and the men and women merely players. McConnell is the latest target. But remember, for Trump, it's always about the base. It's always about the audience. So if we look past the latest target to the audience, that's where the agenda lies for at least our president. And it means that there's got to be some delivery of promises, either a promise to repeal repeal Obamacare, yeah, which is not likely. A promise of tax reform, which is harder now because some of the, the pay-fors in the Obamacare are not going to come through. So there's got to be something. If it's infrastructure, we still haven't seen a plan for that yet. There's no deliverable yet to the audience. And right now, McConnell is the latest target for the reason why.
Sheila, give me your gut, would you, about the current state of the American economy?
Well, I think a lot of the numbers look pretty good, including unemployment, which is 4.3%, which is very low. But I think, as Nila was just mentioning earlier, I think for average people, it does not feel quite so rosy. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how the unemployment number is not reflective of true unemployment. There, you know, a lot of companies that I've spoken to recently are complaining that they're having trouble filling jobs, yet wages are not going up. This is a very confusing phenomenon that economists are sort of baffled by. So I think a lot of people are still feeling a lot of anxiety about their personal financial situation, even though the data looks pretty good. And as we've seen, a lot of the profits are flowing to kind of corporate executive pay. Corporate earnings are very strong. They're still not filtering down to regular people.
Which gets us to where we're quickly, Neil.
Yes, I think Sheila just hit the head here. It's the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. It continues on even this far into the recovery.
Neila Richardson at Redfin and Sheila Kolhatkar. She's at The New Yorker. They were both in New York for us. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, it was, as I intimated earlier, steady as she goes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal today that raised a couple of questions. It was about what's known as the fiduciary duty rule, a regulation pushed by the Obama administration, saying basically that the person making recommendations to you about your retirement accounts should be legally required to act in your best interest. The rule has long been resisted by the financial industry, and this week the Trump Labor Department proposed pushing its effective date back 18 months. Interestingly enough, though, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains, the fiduciary duty rule might actually help brokers, not hurt them.
The goal here is to protect consumers from bad financial advice. The way this rule's playing out in the real world, more consumers are winding up in fee-based investment accounts instead of ones that charge commissions. So say you have $20,000 invested. The fee-based account might charge a 1% fee on that total each year. This shift can be good for brokerage firms, says Gerard Cassidy with RBC Capital Markets.
Over a longer period of time, the revenue from a fee-based account is more predictable and steady and comes in rain or shine.
That can be good for firms, but it can also be good for investors.
Barbara Roper is the Director of Investor Protection for the Consumer Federation of America. She says this move to fees over commissions can be good for the consumer if the fees aren't too onerous.
You have to look at costs in terms of total costs, fees or commissions plus the underlying investment costs. And you have to look at how the incentives influence what people recommend.
Roper says this rule is accelerating a transition that was already happening in the industry. And Michael Wong, an analyst who covers wealth management firms for Morningstar, says it'll have winners and losers.
We believe that the winners from the Department of Labor fiduciary rule will be financial information and technology providers, including robo-advisors and the discount brokerage firms.
Also index funds and ETFs, but it could steer investment out of more expensive, actively managed funds. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
David Lazarus writes the Consumer Confidential column for the Los Angeles Times. Back in 2007, his very first column for that newspaper was about his experience with having his identity stolen. Now he is writing about it again because, it turns out, identity theft never really goes away. David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
This starts 15 years ago with a guy by the name of, you come to discover, Derek Davis.
Yeah, Derek.
Tell me the story.
Derek Davis was living in Connecticut and apparently not here legally. He was from Jamaica. Pulled my Social Security number out of the air. I found out about it when I was refinancing my house and discovered that this guy was in my life and there were listings for him and for Derek Lazarus and for me. I also found out the guy's been having a pretty reckless life. He's been running up bills on credit cards. And he's having a lot more fun than me, bottom line. But it just took forever to not only untangle that, but also to get law enforcement involved.
Here's the thing, though. You did what you were supposed to do. You put your security watches on and you know, you tracked the guy down and law enforcement was aware. Now he's back. 15 years later, he's back in your life.
And it really highlights the nature of identity theft.
Right.
Once your information gets out there, there are thousands of consumer-related databases that this erroneous information gets into. So here's a case where Derek Davis gets back into Connecticut. Mm-hmm. He had been deported, and now he apparently misses a hospital bill in 2012. A debt collector does a search for him and comes up with my home phone number, which indicates that this guy's troubles and my personal information will be interlinked. And so now I've got this debt collector leaning on me.
But You go to Experian, you go to all the credit people. It costs you $20 a month. Oh, by the way, it's not cheap to protect yourself, but there is nothing you can do.
You're right. What you referred to with the $20 a month cost, that's a monitoring program that monitors all three of the major credit reporting agencies. If you know that somebody's got your Social Security number, it's very important to go the next step, and that's what's known as a credit freeze. Mm-hmm. And a credit freeze is where you're going to pay to slam shut your credit files. $10 it costs to do that. And then anytime you want to open your credit files, another $10. But that is a very strong safeguard.
Other than those monthly fees, which, oh, by the way, add up after 15 years, as they have, I'm sure, with you, have you personally suffered any economic damage because of this?
I think the only economic damage was the time lost.
Sure, which is not insubstantial.
Which is not insignificant. And we're talking many, many hours. And in my case, since I was doing a refinance at the time, it meant I had to deal with it very quickly. You know, if any lawmakers are listening, I would think that a very strong thing that can be done would be if you are a proven victim of identity theft, there shouldn't be these costs to protect yourself. You didn't put yourself into this position, all these databases out there that have this bad information. You're a victim of that as well. And as such, this information industry that has grown up and feeds on our personal information, they've got a responsibility.
So that's the last point. It's only going to get worse, right?
It is only going to get worse because we live in an information economy. We live in a digital world, which is why the protections should not be an extra kick in the pants. The protections, in fact, should kick in automatically once you are in this position.
David Lazarus at the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
He's sitting at a desk. It's late one night. He reads the letter and says, oh, my God, I totally remember that place.
America's first trade protectionist. Straight ahead. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 14 points today. Basically flat. 21,858. The NASDAQ up 39 points. 0.6%. 62.56. S&P 500 gained 3 points, about a 0.1%, 24.41. Altogether, though, not a great week for equities. The Dow down 234 points, about 1%. NASDAQ off 95, 1.5%. S&P 500 down 35. That's 1.4%. Basically all of that yesterday. Been a deadly summer at the movies with box office receipts down about 5% so far this year. AMC Entertainment down 2.7%. Today, Regal Entertainment off 0.6%. The summer's only real hit, Wonder Woman. Go see it. It was awesome. Snap missed expectations yesterday. The stock sank 14% today to $11. Remember, it IPO'd back in March at $17 a whack. Facebook up 0.4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.19%. Take that. Jenna Yellen, you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. SoundCloud, the audio platform beloved of indie musicians who upload their music for the world to find, has been struggling. It laid off 40% of its staff last month, and the company has been looking for cash. $170 million is the figure being bandied about. It got that in an emergency funding round today, as well as a new boss, the CEO of the video sharing site Vimeo. But riddle me this, would you? How is it that a company with more than 175 million monthly users can't make any money? Marketplace's Aaron Trank is on it.
SoundCloud launched 9 years ago and quickly became the go-to platform for rising artists and local music scenes. Ted Cohen is a digital entertainment consultant at Tag Strategic.
They found a unique niche that became insanely popular. They became the cool kids because it was all new music.
The music was cool, but the money side, not so much. Digital music consultant Vicky Nauman says the company never really figured out how to generate revenue.
They had this trifecta where they had a big user base, no business model, and they had taken venture funding, so they had a lot of money.
SoundCloud is a repository for countless DJ mixes, chock full of intellectual property, so publishers and major labels came knocking. In the last few years, the company has shelled out millions on licensing deals with those labels. SoundCloud lost about $50 million in 2015.
The clash of how much money it takes to license a music at scale just didn't fit with the financial position of the company.
Last year, to compete with the likes of Spotify, SoundCloud launched a premium paid service called SoundCloud Go, which never really went. The lifeline cash infusion today buys the company more time, but NYU business professor Larry Miller says it has a lot of work to do.
Fix the business model, improve the product, and pay attention to what it is that the core users are asking the service to do.
And that's a tall order for a company in the increasingly competitive music streaming space. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Part of what Donald Trump ran on and won with was the idea that the United States isn't getting its fair share of the global economic pie, hence the slogan America First and the president's interpretation of it, which boils down to protectionism. That's today's installment of our series, Trade-Off, the Costs and Benefits of Globalization. You know, the Trumpian approach to global trade might feel different compared to recent history, but the American industrial economy finds its roots in protectionism going all the way back to this guy.
Don't be shocked when your history book mentions me. I will lay down my life if it sets us free. Eventually, you'll see my ascendancy.
Marketplace's Sarah Gardner takes it from there.
Protectionism comes in a lot of different flavors. It could be a tax on imports, a ban on immigrants from a certain country, or a rule limiting foreign investment. But it all comes down to gatekeeping, controlling who and what flows across your borders in the name of national prosperity and security. Let's take that part about what flows across borders, the stuff we buy and sell. America's got a long history of keeping out imports when it suits us, and that goes as far back as, well, you might call Alexander Hamilton our original protectionist. Now, the Broadway musical skipped over it, so to find that Hamilton, you have to go to Jersey. Patterson, New Jersey. Drive through town and you pass bodegas, pawn shops, discount stores, and then you come to something totally unexpected. A national park, complete with a wisecracking park ranger, Smokey Bear hat and all.
My name's Elise, and I'm highly entertaining. So
Elise Goldman is supervisory park ranger at Patterson Great Falls National Historical Park. This is where the Passaic River falls into a stunning 77-foot chasm.
All right, get your cameras ready. It is a beautiful view.
Goldman tells us Alexander Hamilton actually picnicked here with George Washington during the American Revolution. They ate cold ham and tongue. They drank alcohol. And maybe they planted the first seeds of American manufacturing. Now, we don't know what they said exactly, so Goldman invents some lines for Hamilton.
He gets up from the picnic, he goes over to the chasm, he looks at the falls, and he says, wow, you know, water's powerful.
Powerful enough to turn water wheels to run cotton mills. The British had banned the colonies from importing anything that would empower them to build their own factories. So after the U.S. wins its independence, Hamilton, he's now Treasury Secretary, he wants to change that. An aide writes to him suggesting Passaic Falls might be a good place to build textile mills.
He's sitting at a desk. It's late one night. He reads the letter and he says, oh my God, I totally remember that place. We had tongue.
So Hamilton gets some investors together, and he makes the intellectual argument for homegrown industries in something called the Report on Manufacturers, a real slog, but important. So we took a cue from Hamilton the musical and translated a key idea from the report into lyrics. Now, stay with me. I'm not going to perform, I promise. We called in a professional, Javon Carter, from the Stooges Brass Band.
All right, man, let me get this here a shot. So you want to be free? So you want to be free? So of British tyranny? Of British tyranny? Then gentlemen build? Then gentlemen build? An American factory? An American factory? We tax the goods so high? The goods so high? It'll be foolish to buy? Be foolish to buy? Anything but American? Buy American?
Tax imports by American. You get the idea. That's part of what economists call the infant industries argument for protectionism, helping shield fledgling industries from seasoned foreign competitors so they can get big enough to play with the big kids someday. Hamilton also pushed for government subsidies, money to give homegrown industries a competitive edge. That's another kind of protectionism, but that wasn't as popular back then. Now, Hamilton didn't live to see it. He died in 1804 after dueling with the vice president. But eventually, after several decades, the experiment at Passaic Falls worked. Patterson became a quintessential American factory town.
That small building was the powerhouse to the Ivanhoe paper mill.
Paper and cotton, silk, guns. Patterson and other early American industrial cities succeeded partly because Congress imposed tariffs on foreign goods. In 1816, the U.S. adopted the first tariff specifically to keep out imports, not just feed government coffers. And that launched a long history of American protectionism and a fierce debate over free trade that's still alive today.
I think it's hard for us nowadays to appreciate the extent to which in the 19th century, the tariff was, for many people, a religious conviction.
American historian Eric Rauchway at the University of California, Davis.
Of course, for Republicans and for the majority view in the 19th and early 20th century, to be pro-tariff was to be American.
In fact, some called the GOP the grand old protectionists. Free trade sounded suspiciously unpatriotic. So protectionism, not free trade, was the American way for much of our history. We hear President Trump complain that China unfairly props up its steel industry, dumping cheap steel into global markets. That makes it hard for American steel to compete. People lose their jobs. Well, reality check. We were an emerging protectionist nation once, too. But there's a wrinkle here, and an important one. Some people argue, look, protectionism built America, and we developed into a world power by putting America first.
But what that argument overlooks is the fact that we were completely open to migration. So we had a lot of immigrants.
Dartmouth historian Douglas Irwin says on the whole,
we were completely open to capital flows, and we borrowed a lot of money from British financiers. We were completely open to foreign technology. So we weren't really a closed economy in the 19th century. We were limited trade, but we were open in terms of ideas, capital, the movement of people.
At the end of that tour in Paterson, I ask another tourist, Antonio Montez, what he thinks about free trade. He's worked in manufacturing, law enforcement, now private security. And like a lot of Americans, Montez is searching for that sweet spot when it comes to globalization.
Free trade, I heard, is in an extent, but at the same time, free trade, that helped us. But I think we need to look more and be protective of the U.S., because personally, I've been overseas, a veteran. We give a lot to other countries, and we're not getting nothing back in return.
Alexander Hamilton might have related. He wanted to put America first, too. But Hamilton also understood that protectionism comes at a cost, mainly higher prices for consumers. Hamilton never envisioned protectionism without an expiration date. Ron Chernow, he authored the Hamilton biography that inspired the musical, he writes that in the America Hamilton imagined, tariffs were moderate, temporary, and repealed as soon as possible. In Paterson, New Jersey, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today with a hat tip to our Friday regular, ex-marketplacer and current Bloomberg TV guy David Gura from the New York Times, October the 28th, 1962, the tail end of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Quote, Alan Greenspan of Townsend Greenspan and Company Economic Consultants said, quote, massive uncertainty, end quote, could result if the crisis continued for any length of time. He said this could have a major effect in dampening business expectations, end of quote from the paper. Greenspan, by the way, was 36 years old at the time. He is, as you, I'm sure, know, still around. Also, can you believe we're talking about this? All right, we're out of here on a Friday. The Dow up 14 today. We'll call that basically flat. NASDAQ up 39.6%. S&P 500 up 0.3%. The first reaction from the markets this week to the geopolitical news of the times. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you Monday, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.